disperse immediately or you will be subject to arrest with now.
A boss ain't nothing but a thief on a time loan. 128 been war, you play Nintendo. On some shooter, so put the bridge down. Don't feed us to the killer bees. We get what we deserve, life. Bury me with my MP3s. Write my manifesto in 72 DPI. Life's just a game, you got cheated, never learn. I write these songs every bridge that ain't been burned. For every cop car that ain't been turned.
Welcome to This Is America, August 12th, 2020. On this episode, first we speak with somebody involved in the Los Angeles Tenants Union. We talk about how the organization has grown to include autonomous chapters across the LA area, what organizing the group is involved with currently, ongoing rent strikes, and thoughts on the current threat of mass evictions within the current context of the growing COVID-19 pandemic. We then get into our discussion about the GOP's embrace of conspiracy theories and how this relates to a recent hearing on protest violence held on Capitol Hill. All this and more, but first, let's get to the news.
From the area. Leave the area now.
Large-scale riots and clashes with police have continued to break out across the so-called United States in the wake of ongoing police killings and to mark the anniversary of the police murder of Mike Brown in Ferguson. Last Saturday in Seattle, Washington, people clashed with members of the far-right group the Proud Boys, while another group assembled later that night, breaking windows of various corporate storefronts. In Portland, Oregon, large-scale nightly mobilizations continue, despite federal forces largely being pushed off the streets, while Portland police have continued to fire tear gas and projectiles at demonstrators. Frontline protesters have also been experimenting with new tactics, such as shield walls. On August 9th, demonstrators again briefly set fire to the Portland Police Association office, and the protests show no signs of letting up. In Wauwatosa, Wisconsin, people marched through police barricades to protest in front of the home of a police officer currently under investigation for killing three people over the past 5 years. In Ferguson, Missouri, protests were held on the anniversary of the police killing of Mike Brown, leading to clashes with police and arrests.
If somebody decides to loot a Gucci or a Macy's or a Nike, because that makes sure that that person eats. That makes sure that that person has clothes. That's reparations. That is reparations. Anything they want to take, take it, because these businesses have insurance. They're going to get their money back. My people aren't getting anything.
In Chicago, Illinois, anger built last Sunday in the wake of a police shooting that sent one man to the hospital. After clashes broke out with people at the scene of the shooting, hundreds of people then converged on the Magnificent Mile shopping district and began looting. Police made numerous arrests, but the looting was widespread, highly organized, utilized social media, and people even brought with them boxes of rocks and bricks to break out the windows of luxury stores. The next day, Black Lives Matter Chicago held a rally demanding those arrested the previous night be released, calling the acts of looting reparations. Chicago mayor responded by closing off major bridges and deploying police to set up checkpoints where employees and residents were forced to show ID in order to access certain areas. In Richmond, Virginia, rowdy demonstrations and clashes also continued, leaving windows of a variety of stores wrecked. Rent strikes are continuing and anti-eviction protests have kicked off in a big way across the U.S. Check IGD in the coming days for roundup of actions happening across different cities. Currently, people are holding demonstrations outside of eviction courts to stop landlords from starting the legal process. People are defending homes that are in danger of being evicted and also organizing protests at landlords' offices. In Bend, Oregon, hundreds blocked ICE buses that were transporting several people to be deported. The blockade lasted over 10 hours as hundreds converged around the buses, graffitied them with slogans, and finally faced off with heavily armed DHS agents. Ultimately, the agents were sadly able to extract the two people on the buses. In the East Bay Area, a large crowd protested ICE and then moved to blockade Highway 101 last weekend as demonstrators called for the abolition of the agency. Finally, across the U.S., thousands of teachers and educational staff are organizing protests against the continued push to return students to schools in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic, a move that has already had disastrous results. This has included car caravans, rallies, and protests at school board meetings. Check out a roundup linked in our show notes. In repression news, student workers at the University of California system who were fired during the historic UC Wildcat strike wave have recently been rehired, a massive victory for the Wildcat movement, which has fought for a cost of living wage increase. Several crowdfunding campaigns have been set up for protesters arrested during recent Black Lives Matter demonstrations in Eugene, Oregon. See our show notes for a link.
Fox News alert just coming in, and the feds say they have arrested the ringleader of the attack on the Andrew Jackson statue in Lafayette Park.
The ringleader of Antifa statement is as absurd as it is false. Anyone with access to Wikipedia and 15 minutes of their time can learn these very simple facts. Anti-fascism, or Antifa, is an idea which simply means to be against fascism. If you are against fascists like Nazis, then you are an anti-fascist too.
In Washington, D.C., Jason Charter faces upwards of 20 years in prison following an arrest at a rally where hundreds attempted to tear down a statue of Andrew Jackson. Charter has been labeled a, quote, ringleader of Antifa by far-right media outlets and Fox News. Trump has pushed the DOJ to prioritize prosecution of those involved in bringing down various statues across the U.S. In Salt Lake City, Utah, demonstrators face possible life sentences along with gang enhancements for spilling fake blood and putting up Black Lives Matter posters at the district attorney's office. And now for some anti-fascist updates. In Charlottesville, Virginia, people held a celebration to mark the 3-year anniversary of the deadly Unite the Right rally, where anti-fascist and anti-racist groups stood up against the larger horde of neo-Nazi alt-right militia and KKK members, and Heather Heyer, an anti-fascist and socialist, sadly lost their life. In Douglas County, Nevada, around 1,500 far-right demonstrators, Trump supporters, and militia members rallied against 20 Black Lives Matter protesters in support of a local sheriff who'd received media criticism for attacking the local library for putting out a pro-Black Lives Matter statement. Far-right demonstrators surrounded a small BLM group and chased them back to their cars, yelling racial slurs. In Portland, Oregon, demonstrators have witnessed a variety of attempted attacks over the past couple days, from vehicles trying to run over marchers to someone throwing pipe bombs at protesters last weekend. One of the persons involved in the pipe bomb attack was followed and later ID'd by anti-fascists as Lewis Fernbaugh, a former Navy SEAL with a long history on the far right, along with a deep hatred for anti-fascists. And lastly, in Eugene, Oregon, and in Nevada City, California, Trump supporters clashed with Black Lives Matter protesters. And now for some upcoming events. On August 14th, there is an anti-Trump and anti-fascist counter-protest in Novato, California.
On August 15th, racists and the far right will rally outside Atlanta at Stone Mountain, the birthplace of the modern Klan. The racists want a show of intimidation against recent waves of black-led protest. Here are the people promoting the rally. The Confederate States 3%er militia claims to be about heritage, not hate, but here's the violent anti-black rhetoric in their private group. Chester Doles leads American Patriots USA. He has decades of experience in white supremacist organizing, leading a Klan group, then the Georgia Unit of National Alliance, a neo-Nazi organization. His criminal record includes beating a black man just for having a white woman in his vehicle. Protect the South is also promoting August 15th. It's led by this guy, who used to do this website. Stormfront, a white power site linked to almost 100 murders, is also discussing the rally. These are dangerous racists, and they cannot be allowed to terrorize our community. Join us on August 15th, 9 a.m. at Stone Mountain to tell the far right that they are not welcome.
On August 29th, there's a mobilization against the Hate Pride rally being organized in Modesto, California. And finally, if you value what's going down as a revolutionary autonomous media resource in times of crisis and you want to support us, please go to itsgoingdown.org/shop and give us a one-time donation or sign up to donate monthly. We know that as times get worse, people don't have a lot of money laying around to donate, but if you do have the means or if you just want to chip in a little bit to help us get through these tough times, please go to itsgoingdown.org/shop, sign up to donate monthly, or give us a one-time donation. You can also donate on Bitcoin. We also encourage people to follow us on social media, listen to us on the radio, and as always, tell a friend about It's Going Down. Thanks for listening. As always, enjoy the interviews and the discussion, and we will see you soon.
but judging from the car they drive, I know they not poor, and I could be mistaken because I'm not sure, but I got this little hunch, they the ones calling the cops 4 times last week, saying I'm disturbing the peace, cause I was playing my music and they heard some loud screams. So my neighbor the cop, who I suspect of beating his wife, had to tell me to stop, and I wish I had the guts to tell him about the noise from his apartment, but that's the business that I don't get involved with, so I look the other way, trying to climb higher, cause if I reach the top, I think I could have said goodbye.
Around his knuckles, ready to swing the buckle. I'm thinking, why they fighting each other? They're in the same school, probably live next to each other, under the same roof. I bet they're from my building, yeah, I bet that kid's bad. The drunk I pass on my way up the stairs, real sad. I'm sure they blame him for the tags in the hallway. The robberies, not seeing the reason, he's outside all day. Like they came from nowhere, with the bad intentions. They grew up in this place, we made them who they are. I can see they so scared to use some attention. This house can be a maze without a guiding star.
My name's Sasha. I'm with the Northeast Local of the Los Angeles Tenants Union.
Can you give us like a crash course almost of just kind of the history of the LA Tenants Union? We'll talk about just the size and scope of it, which is pretty large from my understanding. But tell us a little bit about the history of the organization.
Sure. The LA Tenants Union was founded in 2015 by a few neighbors, basically, who were some of them are facing an Ellis eviction. Others had been involved in activism, like in ACT UP, in San Francisco in the Bay Area. And they were getting together to sort of see what, they could do about this kind of like new wave of gentrification that was hitting Los Angeles, as well as fighting these evictions that they themselves were facing. And that, I mean, it's a long story of evolution, but, obviously that went from just a few folks meeting, every once in a while to now 13 locals all across the city. And growing. So we organized very much on a neighborhood by neighborhood basis, as a kind of confederation of autonomous locals that also ties into the union as a whole.
That's amazing. Can you say a little bit more just about how that works? I'm also curious, like in the midst of the pandemic, has that made it harder to organize all this stuff, or are people just stuck on more meetings on Zoom, or how does that look like kind of organizing this neighborhood by neighborhood network?
Yeah, I mean, definitely a lot more Zoom meetings, a lot more kind of ad hoc committees that have popped up to deal with the very specific, very unusual issues that the pandemic has brought about. But I mean, now, I mean, you know, since May and June and the mass uprisings, the landscape looks very different as far as, you know, what is safe, like what is risky. And we are starting to meet with tenants in person. We've started doing these kind of incredible, my local's doing these, a lot of locals are doing these too, these Friday night or Saturday kind of outreach crawls and parades through different neighborhoods. So really just getting the message out, really ramping up our outreach. And that has kind of two functions, right? There's folks who are really facing crises, who don't know their rights, who don't know what they can do, don't know how they can organize. And we want to support them in that. And we're at this point just looking for bodies. Like, we're going to be facing these massive waves of evictions in the fall and the spring. And we're going to need mass membership to really fight that.
You mentioned the terrain shifting because of the rebellion. I'm just curious, can you comment more on that? How would you say that it's changed?
I mean, just as far as leaving your home, right? I think before, I'm just thinking about April, we were like, what do we do? How do we reach people? So much of what gives our meetings kind of power and meaning is that we meet in person in neighborhoods, in community spaces. My local meets at this community art gallery that's, been around forever and serves the community and is kind of like this sort of prized possession in the neighborhood. And suddenly we're on Zoom. The people that we're trying to reach don't necessarily have access to Zoom. And it was sort of, a very different situation from how we are used to organizing, which isn't super technologically based. But we did a lot of work. We managed to now have fully bilingual meetings on Zoom, which was really hard. But as far as, once we started seeing like hundreds of thousands of people on the streets, it suddenly became a lot more realistic and practical to go door knocking and to go out together in public and make ourselves seen and heard. So that's kind of something that's definitely shifted the way that we saw organizing under COVID-19, as far as, just safety.
Well, can you take us back to May 1st of this year? I know that there was like the cancel rent campaign and also the, the food not rent was one of the big slogans in LA. Also, there was this Reclaim Our Homes action that was happening. People were going and taking over vacant homes somewhere in Southern California. I think like the LA Tenants Union was at least peripherally involved in that. Like, take us back to that time and like what's been happening since then.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's important to recognize there was a deep housing crisis before COVID-19. So we already were, our meetings were kind of like ballooning to twice their size. We were already kind of looking for more kind of like mentorship and leadership structures within the locals that would kind of support more organizing efforts and train more organizers. And suddenly, more than half our members were out of work, right? Suddenly people could see that they're not going to be able to make rent already in April. And so everything just had to kind of accelerate. And I mean, honestly, what we're doing now is not that different from what we were doing before. So, Latu, we like to think, and I think this is a fact that, we kind of repopularized the rent strike over the past few years. And like, famously, we, helped the mariachis in Boyle Heights organize, and they won these like massive rent rollbacks. They didn't have to repay their debt from when they were on rent strike against their kind of like vulture developer landlord. And so it's really just drawing on those like years of experience. And I think creating a lot more spaces for that kind of information to be shared so that we can all kind of learn collectively from, what we've learned as a union over the past few years and how we can apply that now. So we launched our Food Not Rent campaign, back in April, which is really just a call for tenants to choose food, to choose medication, to choose, mutual aid for their neighbors before they pay their rent. In fact, we told them not to pay their rent because nobody knew, and still nobody knows, how long this is going to last, right? There's no sign of, everything going back to normal. And what was normal wasn't good in the first place, right? Already so many tenants could not make the rent that was being asked of them in cities like Los Angeles. Here we are today. There's, we've had over 10,000 people access our Food Not Rent Rent Strike Guide. We're organizing like hundreds of buildings across the city, and we're still demanding rent cancellation.
You mentioned just the housing crisis and people losing their jobs. I'm just kind of curious if you can obviously everybody's in a different situation, but in general, like what kind of things are you seeing like citywide in terms of the impact of the pandemic, like people losing their jobs and also just in terms of their situation with paying their rent? Like, what types of things are people going through?
I mean, the scariest thing that we're seeing again and again is people self-evicting. So knowing that they're not going to make their rent and being so terrified of their landlords and so accustomed to this ritual of handing over like over half their paycheck, for many people, 2/3 of their paycheck every month to their landlord, that they can't envision staying in their home without doing that. and they're moving out. We're, you know, every first of the month, we're seeing U-Hauls, we're seeing mattresses out on the street. And so a lot of our messaging has also shifted or kind of expanded to include that, right? Don't self-evict, stay in your home. You actually don't have to pay rent right now in California if you have income loss related to COVID-19, which honestly, you could basically argue anything right now is related to the pandemic because the entire economy is just crashing. That's something that we've been fighting. And on the reverse side of that too, illegal lockouts. So landlords seeing that their tenants are struggling. One tenant that we helped was actually diagnosed with COVID, and her landlord tried to lock her out, or did lock her out, uninstalled her toilet, like left it in her living room, and, you know, just throwing people's stuff out onto the lawn. So a lot of that is kind of sort of triage that we're having to do, which is so unnecessary, so cruel. And a lot of our work has just been empowering tenants to know their rights right now and to leverage them to demand more.
So are there a lot of buildings that are connected to the organizing going on with the LA Tenants Union that are on rent strike right now? And will that continue to grow?
Definitely. That's sort of the big ongoing campaign right now, is really organizing tenants associations. So I know some tenants and unions call them like tenant councils, but whatever you call it, the grouping of organized tenants that live within a building or share a landlord potentially across a neighborhood, organizing together, actually like formalizing their collective. So usually they have a name, like the, you know, whatever, Benner Street Tenant Association, and then bargaining collectively with their landlord. And that is really how we see the kind of like formalization of community power, is really speaking to someone that you see as powerful with the full power, the full force of your community, and with the backing of the union.
I'm curious if you can just talk a bit about what you see happening in California. I know before we started recording, we said that there's like some eviction moratoriums that are still on the books right now. It seems like more so than are in other states. I'm just curious, like, what do you see happening with this? Do you think that they will continue to put those moratoriums in place, or is there going to be a time coming soon that they will take that away? Will that happen before the election? What do you see happening in your area?
Yeah, man, thinking about the election right now is just like whiplash. But I think, so right now there's a very weak, not even really a moratorium in California, but a defense in court. So you can't be evicted right now, but you can be as soon as, you know, the courts reopen. That's kind of our next big battle. And that's really where we see the kind of, that's the key battleground for rent cancellation, really. So in LA, we're probably looking at, or LA County is looking at least 365,000 tenants facing eviction this fall. Or when courts reopen. And honestly, that might happen. The very weak moratorium we have might be overturned in 2 weeks. It might be in 2 months. But regardless, that's so soon. And the sheer numbers are just horrifying. But that's also power, right? So we're kind of working a lot on reframing the way that people are thinking about these things. There are billions of dollars in Los Angeles that are being withheld from landlords right now. You know, whether or not the tenants actually have that money to give doesn't matter. That's money that's not being reinvested back into the real estate market, which eventually will displace those tenants. And that's also how many people, I mean, that's how many cases are going to have to go through the courts, which is they're going to be impossibly clogged. And that's potential. That's that many people that can organize with their neighbors and their communities to stop these evictions by blocking courts, by keeping judges from leaving their homes for court dates, by making that whole process as long and horrible as possible for landlords, that they're going to be forced to negotiate with their tenants.
Well, even if they got their way and all these people were evicted, wouldn't that cause like a massive economic crisis? Because, I mean, if nobody's paying their rent, I mean, obviously then that's not going to the landlords. And then the landlords are going to have to foreclose on their properties. Wouldn't that just create a cascade effect? I mean, it just seems strange because, I mean, even if they got their way and people were kicked out, it doesn't seem like they'd be able to fill all these vacancies, correct?
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing we're wondering, too, is, like, who's going to be moving into these homes? And, I mean, in California, it seems like there's always an endless supply of ever richer people to move into gentrifying neighborhoods. But I think one thing that's important to keep in mind is that mom and pop landlords do exist. They're by far not the majority in Los Angeles. They need to organize for mortgage cancellation, and we support that completely. We understand they're working class landlords, and yeah, they'll suffer if their tenants don't pay rent. But what we're thinking about is really just these corporations that they're not going to be facing foreclosures. They're going to be facing like a small dent in their massive paychecks. And they're sitting on, some of the biggest sums of money in the world right now. So, that's definitely not the side of the story that we're looking at.
Are you seeing any other groups across the country kind of mobilizing in this current context? I know there's been actions in different cities, like New Orleans, for instance, had a pretty big demonstration blocking eviction courts. I'm just curious if you're seeing other cities starting to utilize different tactics in terms of basically responding to this crisis of potentially mass evictions.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think Kansas City also had a really incredible action the other day, and I think they were the ones who also, I don't know the specifics of the situation, but it seems like there were some virtual court hearings, like over Zoom or something like that, and they found a way to just jam the phone lines so that the court hearings had to be canceled for that day. So I think we're going to have to be nimble. There are social distancing guidelines that are probably going to be in place in courtrooms. We don't know if we're going to be able to pack the courts and disrupt them from the inside, or what it looks like really, like what these hearings are really going to look like, or if there will even be jury trials for a while, which could be to our advantage. I think this is all kind of just starting to unfold, and we're going to see some very interesting, very creative ways to combat this all across the country.
Well, for those that are listening, you mentioned one of the big things you're seeing is people self-evicting. If people are listening to this and they're going through something where they're wondering what they're going to do in terms of paying the rent, what advice would you give them?
So it really is the one thing we always say in the LA Tenants Union is we're not lawyers, so this is not legal advice. You need to become familiar with the law as it stands in wherever you live. Approach your local tenants union. They'll know. But just don't be afraid. You're definitely not alone. So many people are in the same position. And one thing that people really need to understand is that evictions are a legal process. It's not just a matter of your landlord coming to your door and saying, I'm thinking maybe you should move out next month. I can offer you a couple $1,000s or something, right? They need to give you legal notices, and you have a lot of rights around that. So I think it's important to know that no matter where you are, the courts are going to be absolutely clogged. And even if you do feel like you're looking at an eviction in the coming months, that probably won't take effect. It probably won't happen until you have your court trial, which in LA, we're looking at like the spring. That's how backed up the courts are going to be. So this is a very long battle, and it also buys you a lot of time to fight for your right to stay.
Like, for instance, in California, obviously, the Democratic, it's a blue state, and a lot of Democrats are at least kind of like, as they have been with a lot of stuff, taking on the language of all these different movements, but, obviously not really doing that much to help people. I'm just curious, like, how do you all navigate that? I mean, is it a tension between, like, some people really wanting to, like, get involved in, fighting kind of, like, in Sacramento at the Capitol, like, against these certain laws and the direct action, like, organizing aspect? Or are people trying to break that down? Or how would you describe just, like, that facet of it?
I mean, in LA Tenants Union, I'll say largely we're an autonomous tenants union, and the power of that is that we don't have to devote all of our efforts to electoral or legislative strategies. And in fact, there are a lot of really amazing, powerful nonprofits in California already fighting in that way. So our work is really just at the neighborhood level. Our messaging, obviously, is for rent cancellation from whoever's in power that can grant it. But ultimately, we're in power. That's how we see it. So canceling rent could look like blocking someone's eviction from ever happening, right? I think there are folks who kind of maybe still are holding out for Gavin Newsom or governor or Garcetti or mayor to cancel rent. But I I mean, ultimately, most of those people are city councilors. Most of them are landlords, right? It's not in their interest to cancel rent. And those of them who aren't landlords have taken money from developers, and gentrification and kind of the displacement of low-income tenants is in their interest. Plus, there's no political will, there's no imagination, and that's kind of what our role is, to imagine the impossible and to bring it into existence.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, with that in mind, I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about the autonomous tenants union network that exists and trying to like bring all these different kind of groups together across a broad territory.
Yeah, Attune is an amazing place to get started. If you have never been involved in tenant organizing, you don't know if there is a tenants union in your area and you kind of want to get a feel for the broader landscape. It's what it sounds like. So it's a network of autonomous tenants unions in Canada and the US, they meet. So I'm not involved in organizing it. I'm a big supporter and have been on some of the calls. But they meet pretty regularly. I think it's maybe about once a month. Usually the meeting is around a theme. So we had a really incredible call with, members of the Debt Collective. And that was very, very helpful in starting to think through the massive rent all across the country. And the continent, really, and how that can actually be leveraged as power. So there's, you know, it's everything from big ideas like that that are being shared between autonomous tenants union organizers, to just kind of the nitty gritty of what organizing looks like in different cities, which is super interesting. You get a lot of perspective. And yeah, I highly encourage everyone to hop on the next call.
Well, just in closing, I guess I would ask, what excites you about this period, as scary as it is with everybody facing so much unknown?
Yeah, I mean, I think you said it. It's the potential, and we're seeing it, right? There's a level of solidarity that we haven't seen before. Our membership has like really grown. And first we were like, are these people really joining? Is this just kind of a fad? But people have really stuck around. So we have a lot more active members now who are really, you know, doing all of the little bits and pieces of organizing that need to get done that we didn't necessarily have the capacity to do before. And I think, I mean, we're just seeing communities really kind of come together. There's, you know, incredible mutual aid efforts that have sort of like energized a lot of neighborhoods where folks have lost a lot of work. And they need that kind of, the neighborhood autonomy that like provides them food from restaurants and farmers markets. So I think all of that is pretty incredible. And I mean, it's much scarier, I think, to have to face all of this on your own. But the benefit to the amount of organizing that's happening now is it's still scary, but we're facing it together.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. It's just amazing to see this type of organizing happening across, you know, a broad area, bringing people together across different neighborhoods. Anything else you want to touch on? Are there any resources or online places that people should go to kind of stay up with what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, if you're in Los Angeles and you don't know about our Food Not Rent guide, go to foodnotrent.org. We also have a solidarity fund right now for rent strikers. So that's not money that's going to landlords or like a rent check. It's money that will go meeting the basic needs of our rent strikers. So food, medication, etc. And that's at foodnotrent.org/donate.
I wrote this to start a fire. I wrote this in memory of Hannah Hire. Fire starter, throwing kerosene on the coals. For the white rose, rest in peace to Sophie Scholl. This for Liber Attic, who fight against the fascists. The Idlewise pirates said, take this day to smash it. The twin kids as I zoom in suit jackets, along with the slurs who wanted Nazis and trash pits. I wrote this for Emma, who lit my soul's inner flame. This is for Ida, who taught us how to liberate. 43 group in the battle of Cable Street, who fought fascists in London, blood left their faces streaked. We rock against racism like the X-ray specs. We're looking for liberation, not paychecks. From Charlottesville to the Valley of Harama, I thought Killjoy told you there's no Nazis in Valhalla.
We never think about Heather but what we laugh or smile, because she often made people laugh. We love the sound of her laugh. A lot of us have videotapes.
We don't all have to sacrifice our lives. They tried to kill my child to shut her up. Well, guess what? You just magnified her.
fascism is not to be debated, it is to be destroyed. The reason cops are haters, cause the Klan they employ. From the Trail of Tears to the streets of Ferguson, from Rikers to Pelican Bay, the state we murdering. We're kicking fascists like St. Pauli, like when Ethiopia fought them with Holly. Lessons learned from Robeson to Chairman Fred. Solidarity, not charity, like Common Ground said. Just trying to find my way like Ellis, a recluse. I'm looking for that strength that Ella Baker knew. Each bar is like John Brown cocking the hammer. We combat the propaganda like the breakfast from Panthers. It's for the CNT and the Mujeres Libres. I'm battling the state of myself, I'm in a fight this three-way. They should not pass, so Passeron is what we say. A place of killer P is what I'm telling the DJ.
I understood exactly what fascism was while I was there. And my intention was to go any place where I could help. I couldn't live with myself today if I hadn't gone then, knowing what happened.
The neo-fascists had their own ammunition, and this is very important to keep in mind, because the police for the most part pulled back. The next day, for example, of the 20 of us who were standing, many of them clergy, we would have been crushed like cockroaches if it were not for the anarchists and the anti-fascists who approached over 350 anti-fascists. We just had 20, and we singing "This Little Light of Mine." You know what I mean? So that
Antifa meaning anti-fascist.
The anti-fascist and the crucial the anarchists, because they saved our lives. Actually, we were.
All right, we're back again for another week. There's a lot going on. I'm sure a lot of people listening to this have seen the recent Axios interview. Pretty interesting. Trump did reference Antifa and anarchists. He said that the reason that the various DHS, Border Patrol, various units in Portland do not have their names on their uniforms, like as if that's the big issue. Really, you know, police have been covering their names for years. Mm-hmm. He was saying that the reason they're doing that is because they don't want to get doxxed. He mentioned the protest outside of Chad Wolf's house, which was pretty tame. You know, there's a couple dozen people. I mean, good on them for protesting. And obviously it's not illegal to do that. You can protest. But he mentioned that as like some, you know, horror show. Also, there was recently a government hearing on protesting, on the riots. The Republicans had someone from a right-wing think tank that's designated as an anti-Muslim hate group. It's the Center for Security and Policy. Someone from that group was there. Also, Andy Ngo was back on the Hill. There's also, interestingly, somebody that identified with the anti-fascist movement that spoke in support, and I guess they read a statement, and that was it. They weren't asking any questions. Yeah, I'm just going off of what other people have written about it. There's a good article that we've been sharing from The Intercept that's about it. It was pretty interesting. Ted Cruz, of course, who has connections to the Proud Boys and groups like the Oath Keepers, he actually mentioned twice the federal security officer that was killed by somebody that was in the Boogaloo Boys, who went on to murder some Santa Cruz police officers and like wrote on his car like Boog, right, and some other things like that in reference to the movement, identified according to social media as a libertarian. Mentioned that federal security officer as somebody that was been killed supposedly by the far left or anarchists or Antifa during the Black Lives Matter protest. And mm-hmm. It's so interesting. I mean, again, like if you think at the justification for federal law enforcement being in Portland to supposedly protect this courthouse, which nobody's inside of besides the police, it's not being used in a downtown area that's largely closed off because of the coronavirus. The justification is that the courthouse itself is being vandalized. Now, think about that in comparison to people being murdered by the far right. And I think it's just interesting, again, that they're mentioning this, but they have to go back and kind of like reconstitute and retell their bedtime story. And it has to revolve around people on the far left engaging in these acts of actual physical violence against living people. But of course, the people doing this are people on the far right. I think it just really speaks volumes to you know, where they're at. So we're going to be talking about, you know, what does this mean exactly? And also, like, where's Trump at in terms of the election cycle? His numbers have kind of plateaued a little bit. It seems like they stabilized. He seems to not be hemorrhaging support anymore. Although the, you know, the distance in points in many areas is pretty wide. In some, like, swing states, it seems like he's, like, a couple points away from Biden. So we're going to be talking about, like, what does that mean? But just to start us off, what are your thoughts on this hearing? How should we take this? This is, I mean, they've had several of these. I mean, they've had Candace Owens come out and talk about white nationalism doesn't exist because she's, of course, a really great person to have talk about anything. You know, Andy Ngo, this is his second time that he's been out there. What does it mean that these things keep happening and also that they're happening at all?
I mean, there's two elements of this that I want to really kind of hone in on. The first is the transparency of what's happening here. So we're going to talk about this later, too, as it relates to Trump. But one of the things that's happened in the right wing, specifically the establishment right wing, as we understand it in relation to sort of Congress and elected officials, is that for decades they've been sort of mired in, you know, dabbling with conspiracy theory. Right. And this goes back many, many, many years, and I would even argue is endemic in conservative movements, right? So if we understand conservatism as an attempt to sort of free social change and impose morality through law, conspiracy theories are sort of almost inherent in that world, right? Like, you have to make people afraid of change and afraid of you know, kind of social dynamics being modified. In order to maintain that kind of a political position, because in reality, it doesn't really have any content. The only content of a conservative political position is nothing should change from this point, or that we should retreat back to some point in the past, right? And so somehow you have to demonize anything that's new. And so conspiracy theories are very common in that world, and you see that kind of internationally. You've seen that over time. But in the right wing in the U.S., one of the things that's happened is that as they've embraced conspiracy theories, especially in the age of the internet, they've also had to come into contact with people like fact checkers, right? People who are going to call them on the fact that what they're talking about is inaccurate, and be able to present evidence that demonstrates that. And so as a result, what they've done is they've kind of, you know, one response to that was to say, oh, well, we're not wrong. That's just the liberal media trying to demonize us, blah, blah, blah. And that is the baseline argument that constructed the conservative media bubble. But the other thing that's happened within that world is that inside of that bubble, these kinds of events happen. Ted Cruz has a hearing about X, Y, or Z, or like has Candace Owens talk about how, you know, she thinks that white nationalism doesn't exist or whatever. And really, those are attempts to play to the people inside of that bubble, the people that don't trust sources outside of that. But outside of that world, what we see from our perspective is an increasingly transparent attempt to construct conspiracy theories, to use official channels to reinforce the validity of those conspiracy theories, and then to use news coverage of those official channels to broaden the reach of those conspiracy theories, right? And so in Ted Cruz's case, a lot of this started with him embracing the whole Antifa as a terrorist organization thing, and then moved on to Antifa is trying to destroy America because white nationalism isn't a problem, and has now moved on to Antifa is a foreign sponsored terrorist group who's trying to burn American cities because Andy Ngo says so. Now, very obviously, if you look at the hearing and you look at the things Cruz was saying from the outside of his media bubble, it's patently absurd. For example, as you already mentioned, he three different times claimed that that cop that got killed in Oakland was killed by an anarchist. Three different times. The first time he said that, he got called out by Dick Durbin, the Democrat from Illinois, who corrected him with a news story which pointed out that the guy was a member of a far-right faction of the Boogaloo Boys. But he kept repeating it. So why would you keep repeating it if it was demonstrably false? Well, you keep repeating it because there's cameras there. Those cameras record what he's saying. Those cameras play that footage on Fox News. the things that are being said by the, quote, witnesses in this are then repeated by Fox News. And so what it does is it says, okay, this isn't a conspiracy theory. Look, there was a whole congressional hearing about it. So it started with a conspiracy theory. It became a congressional hearing, which then validated the conspiracy right-wing media. And this has been a thing which they've been doing with increasing frequency and with increasing transparency. They're not even necessarily trying to hide that this is what they're doing anymore. Because to the people that this matters to, which is their base, the fact that they had a hearing about it is meaningful, even if everybody else says it's a farce, right? The second element of this, though, and I think that this is really relevant, is that their core witness was not Andy Ngo. Their core witness was this guy from the Center for Security Policy, which, for those of you that don't know, the Center for Security Policy was started by a guy named Frank Gaffney. Now, Frank Gaffney is a widely known Islamophobe and a particularly violent one. He's the type of guy who has, you know, said, well, you know, if people in the Muslim world can't stop being terrorists, then we should just bomb all their cities, right? Like, he's one of those types. He takes it to the point of genocide. And Frank Gaffney has been widely condemned, even by the establishment Republican kind of center, for being a racist and an Islamophobe. However, he's still testifying in front of Congress. And so this whole idea of someone from the far right starting a think tank to create legitimacy around their positions is nothing new, right? We saw this in the late 90s with groups like Numbers USA, which still exists and is still a very influential anti-immigration, quote, think tank, right? It's really a sort of anti-immigration propaganda organization, but they call themselves the think tank, right? They write reports which have fancy covers and are a couple dozen pages long to make it look like they're really thinking about these things, so on, so on. And one of the things that happened in America, amongst many others, after September 11th, is the national security apparatus expanded drastically. And in that process, all of these people popped up claiming to be counterterrorism experts or claiming to be experts on extremism, right? Sebastian Gorka, a former White House aide, was one of them. Michelle Malkin, at different points, has presented herself this way. Pam Geller, at different points, has presented herself this way. And part of the reason that literally anybody can say that they're a counterterrorism expert and build a website and end up on CNN is, well, up until recently, there were no real college degree programs for counterterrorism or national security studies or terrorism studies or things like that. That's changed. But many of the people, and there's tons of exposés about this all over the internet, but many of the people that have considered themselves quote unquote counterterrorism experts or extremism experts are people that have absolutely no background in counterterrorism or extremism studies or terrorism studies. None. These are people who are political operatives, largely, who start think tanks. Even if that think tank is only made up of them, they create a think tank name, they register an LLC, they create a website for it, they make it look super legit, they publish a couple papers on their own, like self-publish a couple papers, and all of a sudden they're considered a counterterrorism expert. And so the right wing really seized on this after September 11th, and they created a ton of these really extreme think tanks. One that you might be familiar with, which was created in the late 90s, but kind of along the same lines, is the Project for New American Century, which was the, you know, kind of flagship neoconservative think tank. Now, Project for New American Century actually did have people in it with PhDs and stuff, and people that actually had government experience, and on that level were far more qualified to call themselves a think tank than the Center for Security Policy is. But the Center for Security Policy is one of dozens of these think tanks which exist in the sort of counterterrorism and counterinsurgency or military contracting space, which primarily traffic in right-wing conspiracy theory, but they frame that as intellectual study, right? And so what they're doing is often they're getting grant money for this. They're often getting grant money from people like the Mercer family who funded Breitbart, or they're getting grant money from the Koch family, from the Koch brothers, who, you know, funded Americans for Prosperity. A lot of them get funding from the NRA, right, which of course has a financial interest, or the donors of the NRA have a financial interest in scaring the crap out of everyone about terrorism to encourage gun sales. there's a lot of entities that fund these organizations. But at the end of the day, all they're doing is they're cherry picking evidence to justify already existing conclusions. And we saw that already with, you know, the Center for Security Policy published this report a few days ago talking about how, and this has been making its rounds on the internet, which is why I'm bringing it up, but talking about this Homeland Security document and then trying to elaborate on it and say, okay, so some people in the United States that identify as anti-fascist also went to go fight for the YPG. Okay, that's where the Homeland Security document ends. Where the Center for Security Policy takes it is they go, the YPG is connected to the PKK. The PKK is a terrorist organization. Therefore, Antifa is a foreign-funded, foreign-trained terrorist organization. It's an absurd argument, right? Especially considering that, well, the U.S. Air Force was flying air cover for the Americans that were there fighting for the YPG, right?
Also, I mean, all the forces there that are aligned against ISIS that are for, you know, the Kurdish population there. I've made it very clear what they want. Please, the United States, don't abandon us so we can be slaughtered by the Turkish military and the remaining forces of ISIS. I mean, their desires are pretty well known. It's to be not mass genocided. So, I mean, this idea that somehow people are going to be acting under the auspices of some foreign entity, which is like hiding in the mountains, you know, just the idea that, you know, quote, Antifa in the United States is going to be acting on their behalf and therefore engaging in some sort of, you know, military operation that's going to result in hurting actual members of the public or even affecting the government is just ludicrous. Especially when you factor in the fact that, you know, as you said, the United States at one point was, you know, running defense for these same forces.
They were arming these same forces and they were arming the Americans that were over there fighting for the YPG. And this is the part that's really amazing because, of course, Trump has picked up on this since the Center for Security Policy published this article. And he is now talking about this. What is absolutely mind-blowing about that is that for the whole first 2 years of the Trump administration, Trump was trying to say, well, the PKK are terrorists, but the YPG are not. And because they're not, we're giving them guns and flying air cover for them because they're okay, but the PKK is not. And he very specifically based that entire foreign policy decision on the fact that the YPG was not a terrorist organization. And now he's saying Antifa are foreign-funded terrorists because they went to go fight for a terrorist organization, which is the exact same group that got guns from the United States. It's mind-blowing. It'd be like in the middle of the Iran-Contra scandal, Reagan getting on TV and going, all those like right-wing militias down in Nicaragua that we've been funding, they're all terrorists, but we're still giving them guns, right? Instead, what did Reagan say? He said, they're not terrorists, they're freedom fighters, that's why we're supporting them, which was the exact same argument they used in relation to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, right? And so U.S. foreign policy is very grounded in this notion that at least on paper, on an official level, the U.S. government does not fund terrorism, right? We all know that that's not true, but on paper, that's always the claim. And so often they, you know, declare groups that they're working with not terrorist organizations. And in this case, very specifically, as you mentioned, the YPG has very limited goals. Those goals don't extend beyond the borders of Syria. They are not the PKK, very declaredly. They're structured entirely differently than the PKK. And again, very much not a terrorist organization as the United States or Europe considers it. And so
not only that, but I mean, the whole goal of the Kurdish project was to create a non-state entity, a system of autonomous administrations across, you know, a large territory that would be under self-administration, not a state. I mean, literally that is, I mean, we can
democratic
debate whether or not that's true, but I mean, literally ideologically speaking, that is the goal.
Yes.
So the idea that somehow, I mean, again, to me, this just reeks of like, oh, okay, let's just take these tropes from the Cold War and just, you know, move them up to 2020. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden we have these anarchists running around and they're really controlled by some state that apparently they want to get rid of, you know.
But more importantly, what it is this is the cynical use of discourse in order to support political positions which are fundamentally incorrect, right? It's charlatanism. And that is very much what has taken over on the right wing, is that it does not matter anymore within right-wing discourse whether or not any element of what you're saying is verifiable. In the past, it used to be that conspiracy theories were built off some sort of verifiable information, okay, at some point. However, 9/11 conspiracy theories, for example, okay, were grounded in the idea that obviously that building didn't collapse like normal buildings, so it must have been blown up from the inside. Now, of course, physics says that that's not true. And physics can explain the implosion of a skyscraper very well, specifically for the reasons that, you know, people have described. But in theory, they could say that's a weird pattern for a building to collapse, then therefore conspiracy theory, right? There's usually some kernel of something that is at least mildly believable at the base of a conspiracy theory. What's happened in the right wing, though, is that that's no longer true. So you can't even look at even U.S. foreign policy and believe the argument that was being made by the Center for Security Policy during that congressional hearing. It would be literally impossible unless you were trying to say that really Trump fooled everybody and told us that we needed to go fund terrorists. And then you have to explain why Trump is funding terrorist organizations.
Not only that, but I mean, let's be real. I mean, there are not only people on the, you know, anarchists or people on the left over there. There's also, you know, a lot of veterans.
Oh, yes.
You know, there's a lot of, you know, probably what we would call right-wing people yes. that are just, you know, really against ISIS yep. for their own reasons. Yep. And some of those people are fighting with the YPJ and other forces. Yes, so, I mean, you know, they're fundamentally saying that those people, too, I mean, I'm sure those aren't the ones that they would want to target, yeah. but they would, you know, it's interesting, too, because in that DHS discussion document, they end by saying there's really nothing here.
Yeah.
You know, there's no actual, you know, there's no actual evidence to support the idea that somehow these people are connected to foreign entities and therefore they're quote doing stuff for right. them. I mean, they literally did what they said they did. They went over and they fought ISIS.
And then they came home and stopped. Yeah. And like, so what's spectacular about the Center for Security Policy article, which then got, you know, sort of repeated during this hearing, is how very specifically wrong it is, right? It's not just that it's not based on anything verifiable. It directly contradicts the very source that they're citing as the core of the article.
Right, it's right.
Amazing. And so when we're thinking about things like this, it's really those two elements that are coming together. We have this sort of faux legitimacy that the right wing has built for itself by calling its propaganda outfits think tanks, and how the, you know, confusion around what counterterrorism and extremism studies are allowed the space for that to happen in the time after September 11th. But we also have an element in which that's being encouraged because they're essentially engines to generate conspiracy theories that justify the policies of right-wing politicians. And so people like Tom Cotton, who the senator from Arkansas, the guy who wrote the article in the Washington Post, the op-ed, about calling the tanks in to shut the protests down, that guy, the guy who last week said that, how did he put it? How did he say? Oh, slavery wasn't all bad. That guy has connections to a number of these kind of right-wing counterterrorism think tanks. Right. And he gets a lot of his policy ideas from them. These right wing think tanks also were responsible for writing the Arizona ID bills that allow cops to ask for IDs from anyone that's brown, essentially. That was written by a right wing think tank. Right. Right wing think tanks also do things like write right to work laws in a lot of states. Right. They write laws that lower environmental regulations. Right. These are core conservative pro-capitalism policies that are retroactively being justified by already existing political operatives who are legitimizing their work by calling it a think tank, right? And the funding exists for this because they play this role. And so what Ted Cruz was doing here is Ted Cruz was talking to the Republican base, that the right wing, we talked about this a lot on the show, but the right wing has kind of run into this trap where in order for them to continue on the way that they've been operating, what they have to do is they have to alienate people. Every single time they target a different group of people, they alienate people, right? They have to say things which are false, demonstrably, which every once in a while, someone within their media bubble gets enterprising enough to go look it up online and figures out they're getting lied to, right? That these kinds of lines, if they sort of attach to the way that people are thinking socially, can be incredibly powerful. But once they start to fall out of sort of mainstream thought, become these sort of expressions of the isolation of the right wing, become these sort of expressions of how far removed from demonstrable reality they are. And that becomes an incentive for people to not affiliate with them. And so for as much as what Ted Cruz did, for as much as that's disturbing, for as much as people like Andy Ngo have literally no place on Capitol Hill, for as much as the Center for Security Policy is more or less an openly racist organization that is testifying in front of the Senate, outside of all of that, all of which is absolutely disgusting, I don't particularly see anything coming out of this, especially because Republicans in the Senate are so deeply discredited because of the way they handled the impeachment.
Well, I think it shows kind of like where they're reaching for.
Yes.
And I think the other thing that, I mean, to most people listening to this, especially if you know anything about the history of the left or anarchism, I mean, this gentleman, Kyle Schedler, it's hard to pronounce his last name. He looks like the bad guy in like a bad 90s movie. He's like a big dude. He's bald. He looks like, you know, somebody at a bar checking an ID that really doesn't want to be there, or like, you know, nondescript bad guy in like Beethoven 7 that like comes after the dog and the kids, you know, or something like that. But like, you never know his name because you don't need to. He's, you know, he's going to be gone at the end of the movie, and that's okay. But anyway, yeah, the other thing he tried to put forward was like some weird connection between like, quote, Antifa and like, the Weather Underground, yeah, or the Red Army faction. Yeah. You know, the Weather Underground was essentially like, you know, a Maoist and, you know, very openly state communist, mm-hmm, section that grew out of the SDS, you know, was in no way, shape, or form in favor of anarchist, anti-authoritarian politics. I mean, you can talk to people back then, mm-hmm, and they will obviously run down, I mean, the difference between the two groups, yes, or, you know, the, you know, the Weather Underground and people that obviously supported anarchist, anti-authoritarian, politics. The Red Army faction, again, was a Marxist-Leninist armed struggle group that existed in the 70s in Italy. You know, as part of kind of a
Germany,
you know, Germany. You know, there's obviously a film you can watch. There's the Biedermeierhof, mm-hmm, complex. Mm-hmm. You know, it's an interesting film. These people weren't anarchists. I'm sure all the people involved would have described themselves as against, quote, fascism, in the sense that, you know, they were opposed to the political system of fascism, but they were in no way, shape, or form, I would argue, connected to, I mean, whatever we want to describe Antifa as, like a loose collection of people fighting fascism, you know, in the current period. I mean, again, this just seems to be grasping at straws. It's like, here are some names of groups that engaged in pretty hardcore actions. I mean, again, in the United States, the Weather Underground, the only people ever associated with that group that ended up dying were people that were part of the group that blew up a bomb and killed themselves. Mm-hmm. They never actually engaged in anything that harmed human beings. They did blow up buildings and stuff. But again, you know, it just seems to be taking something that really weighs on the minds of conservatives, which is, I mean, the Weather Underground is one of those groups that they're going to be talking about the Weather Underground for like the next like 50 years, oh, probably. Yeah. And a lot of that's because, you know, some of those people like have gone on to become, mm-hmm, you know, professors and stuff. And I think they tried to make like some tangential relationship between,
because some Bill of them. Bill Ayers is now a like public education professor, advocate and professor, right, in Chicago, with Bernadine Dorn, who also was a member of Weather Underground and his partner.
Right.
And they had tangential connections to Obama when Obama was a community organizer there, also working on education policy. But this was like in the 80s and 90s, right? So like long after they come up from being underground and renounced armed struggle and all of that.
But again, I mean, this is you know, this is part of what the right often tries to do, is to try to paint these elaborate networks of like, well, there's Obama with the Weather Underground and the Antifa all together working in tandem. I mean, when the reality is that like all of these things are very actually like, in some ways, like diametrically opposed to each other. I'm sure at the time when, you know, the former Weather people were in the same circles as Obama working as a community organizer, they probably would have been the first people to disavow their former actions. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know. It's, but again, like there's a reason for doing that is because, you know, by pointing out those connections to people, I mean, especially people that like, you know, have a very visceral understanding or surface level understanding of like the left and like, you know, far left movements. I mean, if you can connect somebody to the one thing that they know, like the Weather Underground, you know, then you can score a point and you can like make that connection in somebody's minds. Like I remember one time we got an email from somebody, somebody on the right, and they were trying to say that the Weather Underground had manipulated all of the young white people into being racist against white people. And their argument was, is that because some of the people in the Weather Underground had gone on to become professors, therefore they had control over apparently the entire public education system, and they had somehow masterminded this plot, making white people hate themselves and then thus turning them into anti-racist, which then of course is causing apparently all the riots. So, you know, and we wrote back and just said, like, think about what you're saying. Like, you really think that they have that much power? You're talking about two washed up old leftists sitting in academia. They're not in the streets organizing people. They're not like people that have a massive platform. They're sitting there talking about, you know, American history or government, just like every other, you know, like person teaching in a, you know, public or private institution. Like, do you really think, that your forces, like in the government and in the industry are that like powerless that they can't stand up to like two like professors that no one really talks about anymore? Yeah. Like you really think that that's really the way the world works?
Well, and what it comes down
they,
to,
they didn't really have an answer to that. Yeah. But I mean, again, it's just like this animation of, you know, what if and conspiracy. And it's really bizarre.
Well, what it comes down to is a declaration of otherness, right? So people on the right wing identify themselves as, you know, the culture or the mainstream, right? You like hear this language out of them all the time, like Trump, we need to protect our culture, right? Tucker Carlson saying the same thing. And so they interpret themselves as almost a default, right? That they're the default stance. They're the default people of space. And then what they do is they identify otherness. So otherness could be about sexual or gender identity, for example. It could be about race. It could be about politics. And then they assume that all of the people that they have identified as others are working together to somehow undermine the way of life of the, quote, culture, right? And you hear this language come out of the right wing a lot. But so when you combine that with the idea that understanding politics on the left and post-left is hard, right, and that there's a lot of background reading you need to do in order to understand the nuances here. And then you combine that with the fact that we're still just coming out of the Cold War, even though it ended 30 years ago, we're still just coming out of a Cold War mentality in which all of those differences had been eliminated in public discourse. Everybody that wasn't like super pro-America was a communist, right? And the intellectual laziness of those perspectives. And when you add all that together with a sense that, you know, with the sense that it seems that white folks in rural areas and suburban areas have, in which they view themselves as victims under threat. So when you combine white grievance with all of that, you get these kind of elaborate conspiracy theories. Glenn Beck is always the greatest example of this because he has chalkboards. But if anyone ever really wants to see how wild that can get, go back and watch episodes of Glenn Beck's show from when he was still on Fox and watch him roll like four chalkboards out onto a stage and just draw a bunch of boxes with names to them and draw lines between them and go, this is the network that's trying to do X, Y, or Z. Look, it's the SEIU and the communists and Hezbollah, and they're all working with the animal rights activists to do this and this. All that is him drawing connections in his mind as it relates to different entities that he identifies as other, right?
Yeah, there was somebody real quick at CPAC that that had this new book come out, and I don't know, I forgot the name. I mean, somebody that comes up once in a while, but his whole thing was that there was a secret history, of course, between the Bolsheviks and Islam.
Yeah.
Which is, of course, great for them because, you know, they have to re-up these conspiracy theories for new groups. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, his whole thing, if he can make the argument that, like, Islam was really, you know, in bed with the communists, so therefore, you know, the struggle against Islam now is just the same as the global struggle against communism. You know, we need to continue the same project, so on and so forth. I mean, that will obviously be very, you know, advantageous for these groups. And I think what's really interesting about, you know, the guy that spoke for the Center of Security Policy, this organization is in fact heavily funded by the defense industry. Mm-hmm. If you go to, it's going down on Twitter. We have a thread about it, but there's an article from Salon. It says far right birthers. This group was one of the main entities that was pushing the birther conspiracy that Obama wasn't born in the U.S. and was a Muslim, so on and so forth. So Salon has this article about defense contractors and aerospace corporations pouring lots of money into this think tank. Yeah. And you might ask, well, why would they want to support some like weird racist anti-Muslim group? Well, it's because they're pushing actively for, you know, regime change and intervention in these countries that are heavily populated by Muslim people. So what I think is interesting though is that these groups that were basically just talking about Islam a couple years ago have now kind of like updated to talking about Antifa. But what's interesting is that they're trying to basically do the same thing as that they did with Islam a couple years ago, is now they're trying to say, well, Antifa is just one part of this global expanded web of terrorism that includes Islam. And really the Antifa just get all their orders from the PKK, which are, you know, pretty much Muslims, right? You know, up in the mountains of Syria somewhere. So, I mean, again, it all kind of ties back into their ultimate project, which is that, you know, these weird people of color over there in another part of the country, what's our oil doing under their sand? We've got to, like, you know, take them out and take over their space.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, like, this whole element of right-wing think tanks, I mean, as you just mentioned, being funded by the defense industry, again, it's not just that they're off to the side over there justifying policies. Though these right-wing, quote, national security think tanks are deeply embedded in the entire military-industrial complex at this point, just as much as military contractors are, just as much as the defense industry is. And that makes them particularly dangerous. We've been seeing how right-wing thinkers have impacted the Trump administration, but one of the things that's really fascinating is how right-wing think tanks impacted the Bush administration and the ways that framed certain policies. So, for example, the war in Iraq, right, we all know was motivated by, you know, let's put it this way, a creative interpretation of intelligence. They lied to everybody, right? But there were plenty of think tanks out there writing reports that were saying, yes, you're going to invade Iraq and they're going to love democracy and they're going to welcome you as liberators, blah, 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 blah. And those were cited by Donald Rumsfeld to justify the war, right? The fact that we're still technically in Afghanistan was the result of, in many ways, policies put forward by right-wing think tanks around things like drone strikes. Them saying that, well, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda are really the same thing, and so what we need to do is we need to wipe them off the map. And at various points when negotiations had started with the Taliban to end the war, pressure got put on from the center and from the right wing using arguments from these think tanks to kill the negotiations to end the war so they could keep the war going. Why would people want to keep the war going? Well, wars are very profitable. And so, like, these entities, I mean, they're not just, you know, wing nuts writing papers. Like, they're part of the military-industrial complex now.
You know, what's also interesting, too, about the CSP, the Center for Security Policy, you know, they've had numerous fundraisers at Trump's Mar-a-Lago, yes. you know, golf course in Florida. They've held rallies where Trump and Cruz has spoken. Originally, when Cruz was running, remember in 2016, he was running against Trump for the Republican nomination. He was saying that he was going to have the leader of that think tank, Frank Gaffney, on his foreign policy team. Yeah. And I mean, a lot of people would argue that, you know, the CSP would help basically Trump draft the Muslim ban. So, I mean, really, at a certain point, you've got to ask, literally, this is just like different aspects of the state having a conversation with itself and then being presented to the public as, you know, some sort of like outside expert being called upon, when really these are just, you know, parts of the same apparatus putting on a show in order to justify the kind of policies and things that they want to, you know, put forward.
Absolutely.
Which, I mean, pretty sick. I mean, when you factor in the fact that these people are backed by big corporations that want pretty horrible things across the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And so this congressional hearing, I mean, is a fascinating study in the way that right-wing conspiracy theory is constructed in 2020. Because conspiracy theories are now constructed from the floor of the Senate. And it is absolutely stunning that that's what's happened with this process. And we're going to get into in a second why, right? We're going to talk about wedge issue politics and the Southern strategy and Trumpism and what's going on with the election in a second. But what we need to see at this point is just how transparently this hearing was an attempt to construct a conspiracy theory from the floor of the Senate to help Trump reinforce an electoral argument that he's trying to make in TV ads right now, essentially.
Well, you know, we could talk a lot more about this. I encourage people to read up on this group. Definitely an interesting dive if you want to see, you know, really far-right groups with pretty extreme agendas being tied directly to the state, to the Trump administration. But let's kind of go forward and talk about what's been happening with this whole election thing they say is going to happen. You know, there's just been, I mean, you got to give it to the Axios interviewer. I really felt that's the first time, like, you know, a journalist has, I don't even want to say push back, but just kind of like, you know, visibly articulated just kind of the frustration of listening to Trump say anything. It's like, what are you talking about? You know, we're lower than the world. What does that mean?
So
and just kind of affirming basic things like, you know, look, like 1,000 people a day are dying. It is what it is.
Yeah,
it is what it is.
If people have not seen this Axios interview, just watch it because it's hilarious. It's hilarious. It's disturbing, but it's hilarious. It's sort of hilarious in the only way that things can be in 2020, which is sort of like, groan, ha ha, groan, I'm really sad, ha ha, that's funny. It's absurd. It's completely absurd. It's entirely incoherent. Entirely. And people saw that. I mean, like that Axios interview got a lot of play. And since then, what I think has been interesting is Chris Wallace from Fox News has pushed back on Trump a couple of times on things. You're getting journalists from CNN who are starting to really be, like Peter Navarro got, was run through the ringer during an interview, just yesterday by, I think Aaron Burnett on CNN. And so journalists are definitely starting to push back on some of this kind of stuff.
Where do you see things at right now in terms of Trump?
Yeah.
I mean, are we still looking at this thing like, you know, it's looking like he will not be reelected. You know, has the past 2 weeks like shown anything different? I mean, there seems to be in front of us just, I mean, nothing's really has changed. Like things keep getting worse. I mean, also at the same point, I mean, regardless of what's ever being talked about in the media in terms of, you know, either Portland or coronavirus, there isn't a lot of discussion, I would say, around the fact that Congress didn't do anything in terms of the stimulus or unemployment. They basically just let that thing slip through their fingers. There's still talk about doing something about it, but I mean, right now people are not getting their $600 anymore.
Right.
Also, a lot of states are in the midst of, you know, going through the motions of mass evictions, at least bringing those things to court. I know in some states like California, like on this podcast, we talked to somebody in the LA Tenants Union, about there's still a moratorium in place in California. But in other states, I mean, they're saying that like upwards of 60% of renters might be affected by the fact that they don't have enough money to pay for their rent. Yeah. So I think like, and you know, also factor into the fact that, demonstrations right now are popping off mm-hmm. from teachers because they don't want their kids to go back to school mm-hmm. in the face of the coronavirus. I know that some groups of kids in some districts have gone back and there's already been reported cases. I think there's some cases where even kids have maybe even potentially died from contracting coronavirus after they've gone back. So, I mean, anger and action are starting to really boil up in that sector. Right. So I think we've got to kind of ask ourselves how that all factors in as well.
Yeah. So one of the things that's changed, and this has been mostly over the last week, is there's starting to be a conversation about where the basement for Trump is, essentially, right? So for the entirety of the Trump administration, by and large, he has been hanging out at around 42 to 45% approval rating, right? With over 50% disapproving. So anywhere between 50 and 55% of people disapproving, which really means that at any one given point, 6 to 8% of the voting population is up for play. Still is undecided about whether they absolutely hate him or absolutely love him, and they live somewhere in the middle. That is a ridiculously small number of people in any other administration, right? That any other administration, you usually have 10 to 20% of people are sort of in the middle. Then you've got another 10 to 20% of people that are sort of not very strongly on one side or another. With Trump, almost everybody is polarized in one direction or another, right? What that means is that this whole election is really about a couple of things. The first is voter turnout, right? How many people can they get to the polls? What's become really fascinating about that conversation is that Republicans in Congress are quietly and increasingly not so quietly trying to tell Trump to shut up about mail-in voting. Because they're like, yo, we need mail-in ballots to be cast in Florida. We're going to lose Florida. You know, we need that to happen in Texas, too. Or we're going to lose Texas. And they keep trying to tell them to shut up about mail-in voting because they themselves actually need mail-in voting to happen. Otherwise, they're going to get trounced.
Yeah, that was one of the best things of the Axios thing. Yeah. Is he was like, look, dude, like, you're literally emailing your own people saying, like, do the mail-in voting. Yes. Like, your daughter just did a robocall for yep. it. He's like, you need mail-in voting. Why are you saying that there's some conspiracy behind it? And, you know, a lot of people are saying that he's going to, like, try to selectively enforce who gets to engage in that.
And he's been doing that. So yesterday he issued a bunch of praise for Florida's mail-in voting and then threatened to sue Nevada for their mail-in voting process, which is almost exactly the same. But why would they do that? Well, in Florida, he needs mail-in voting in order to win. If he doesn't, he's going to lose in Florida. He needs to increase turnout in Florida because he is losing in the polls right now. But in Nevada, he's losing dramatically. He's down double digits. Nevada is widely considered to be a swing state. He's losing by double digits. And so what he's trying to do in Nevada is he's trying to suppress voter turnout. And so what's amazing about that, though, is that anybody paying any attention can see how transparent the attempt is. And every single time he does this, every single person that isn't, you know, in the cult, essentially, looks at that and goes, oh, this guy's trying to set us up so he can steal the election, because that's obviously what he's doing, right? Anybody with any understanding of political strategy knows that he's sowing doubt so he can sow doubt about the results of the election, right? And every time he does that, people that, again, are not a member of the cult, essentially, of Trumpism, look at him and go, that guy's a threat to American representational democracy. And that is exactly what the Biden campaign has been running on, essentially. Which is, you don't have to like me, that guy's an existential threat to the American system. And they're not wrong. He is an existential threat to the American political system. That is absolutely the case. And so what has happened in this election is that as it became very clear to people over the first half of this year that he was engaging in actions to, you know, for the purpose of political gain, which were putting people's lives at risk, that he was willing to call the military out on demonstrators, that he was willing to use what essentially equates to secret police, that the Justice Department was willing to engage in wholesale civil liberties violations, which are still ongoing, and that he's willing to, you know, essentially put the entire electoral system in jeopardy for his own gain. Most people are looking at that and saying, okay, impeachment stuff aside, regardless of how you feel about that, this is really obvious what's going on here. And at that point, he started hemorrhaging support. And so that's been going on for a couple of months, is he was hemorrhaging support. And he is down in double digits in Wisconsin and Michigan and almost Pennsylvania. I think he's down 8 or 9 points in Pennsylvania. He is losing in Ohio. He is even with Biden in Texas and Georgia, and he's losing Florida. Right. So he's not in a good position. But so this past week, the numbers leveled out. He stopped hemorrhaging support. And all these articles came out asking why. What did Trump do to stop hemorrhaging support? But I think it's really obvious. If you look at the actual numbers, what the actual numbers say right now is about 40% of American adults are going to vote for Trump, and about 60% of American adults are going to vote against him, right? Not necessarily they're going to vote for Biden, but they're not going to vote for Trump. And so what that means is that Trump hemorrhaged support, but the support that he was hemorrhaging were people that weren't enthusiastic Trump supporters. And he lost almost all of those. And at that point, everything restabilized because there's no one left for him to lose and there's no one left for Biden to gain. That pretty much at this point, the electoral field is set. And we're unlikely to see much movement unless Trump really screws up. More so somehow than currently, but does so in a way which fundamentally impacts the lives of his supporters in a negative way, that he can't disavow. If he does something like that, we're going to see movement. But generally, Biden's strategy of do nothing, let Trump defeat himself, has actually been really successful, because nobody needs to vote for Joe Biden. People need to vote against Donald Trump. And everyone that's going to vote against Donald Trump has more or less already made the decision they're going to vote against Donald Trump. So we're not going to see any movement in the polling between now and Election Day. I think what becomes the operative question, and I think that this is a question that extends in importance beyond the election itself. The operative question is, how far is Trump going to go to try and stand in the way of the election operating smoothly, right? Which we've already heard reports that they're cutting shifts at the postal service, not because of budget cuts, but because of personnel staffing issues, which is making the mail get delivered more slowly, which again impacts the delivery of mail-in ballot applications, impacts the delivery of the ballots, impacts the return of the ballots, blah, 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 blah. He can then leverage those issues to say, look, the election is flawed because the Postal Service didn't get all the ballots in. Like, he's going to do this. And everybody knows he's going to do this. It's very obvious. The question, I think, the operative question of this election is not whether Trump is going to win the popular vote or even the Electoral College, because if things stand the way that they are, he's not going to. There's literally no way. He is not even close. To put this in perspective, for people that still have trauma from the last election cycle, at most nationally, Hillary Clinton was up against Donald Trump by like 4 points. In the individual states that she lost that were decisive, so Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, at most she was only up 1 point the entire election. Biden is up double digits in Wisconsin and Michigan and up 8 or 9 in Pennsylvania. That's a very different reality, right? And so unless something really drastic happens, this election is more or less already moving towards getting decided. I think what becomes the operative question is, again, how much does the Trump administration try and stand in the way of the election? And what is the response of people on the ground when that happens?
Well, I think this is actually an interesting point. And I mean, also, too, because when does mail-in voting really start? It starts, like, what, in October?
Yeah, middle of October, early middle October. It depends on your state.
But, I mean, that's really when the election is going to start,
yes.
You know?
Yes.
Yeah, I think, like, you know, we haven't even really got into some, like, what-ifs, like, you know, I know already there's people saying, like, there should be people outside the White House, you know, there should be mass marches now. I think those are interesting conversations. At the same time, I mean, like, you know, there's a lot of other people saying, like, you know, there should be a general strike for the teachers right mm-hmm. now because they don't want to force kids to go back to school. Like, we've got bread and butter issues we've got to deal with. We've got to deal with the fact that, like, upwards of 30 to 40 to 60% of the people, working people in this country that are renters are about to be evicted. I mean, the other questions I have is, like, we're talking about some, like, disastrous things that are going to have huge effects on the economy.
Yeah.
What is that fallout going to be? I mean, in the interview you'll hear before this with the person from the LA Tenants Union, we asked the basic question, like, even if they were able to kick out all those people, do they even have enough people to, like, buy, you know, rent those new homes? And, like, won't all those evictions in turn, like, cause a cascade of foreclosures that'll send the economy further into crisis?
Yeah, I mean, if they were going to try and do anything about the economy, they would have done it before the unemployment benefits ran up, right? Like, what we're looking at, so far, the economy being, quote, stable, even in the midst of historic unemployment, has entirely been the result of the fact that the U.S. government has been giving people money to spend. Once that ends, which it did at the end of the month, at the end of July, once that ends and whatever money they had squirreled away and saved during that period of time is gone, not only are you going to see mass evictions, but when people get evicted from their homes, well, they have to save money to get a new place to live. They're not spending money. When people aren't getting unemployment benefits, they're not spending money. When people aren't getting stimulus checks, they're not spending money, because right now working a job to get money to spend is not entirely realistic for a lot of people. And so we are looking at a situation which was being artificially held up by the state, right? So all of these Republicans who drone on and on about free market this and free market that, blah, 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 were the ones that supported the government bailing the economy out again. And so that bailout period is over. And what happens now is we get to see what the actual economic effects of the crisis were, which is that nobody has any money to spend on anything, and the American economy is based 70% on the service industry and consumer consumption. And so if there is no money to spend eating out or going on vacations or buying stuff at Walmart or Target or whatever, that's 70% of the economy that gets impacted immediately. There's nothing he can do to stop that. And so not only are the protests around police violence likely to continue, especially in certain parts of the country where, you know, they're still ongoing, right? But that's very likely to be joined by, as you mentioned, labor demonstrations, specifically around teachers. I think that there's likely to be other labor-based demonstrations around labor conditions in, you know, warehouses and things like that. It is very, very, very likely that you'll see protests around Trump trying to interfere with the election. And then more than anything else, if he refuses to accept the results of this election, we might end up with our people want to overthrow the regime moment, right? We might end up in a situation where thousands of people go to Washington, D.C. and don't leave until he's out of office. I think that that is probably as likely, if not more likely, than Biden winning the election and Trump accepting the results.
I don't want to sound conspiratorial, but I know that any groundwork that they make in terms of, you know, creating a boogeyman out of anarchists or Antifa or Marxists or the Babadook or, you know, whatever it is this week, I mean, that's going to help them when that really kicks off.
Yeah.
And I think really that's the horizon that they're really scared of.
That is absolutely, you know, not that they the horizon are, they, that they're scared of.
They weren't scared about, you know, this uprising, but I mean, what happens when that meets, you know, the thousands of, you know, teachers in West Virginia that already know what they're doing.
Well,
that already went through a wildcat strike, that already stood up to their unions.
Yes.
That already know what it's like to organize en masse and carry out a strike in the face of the National Guard being called in against
them.
And them to roll up their sleeves and be like, well, it's time to do what we do best.
Yeah.
Put on the red handkerchief. Yeah. You know?
Well, and we're already watching the precursor steps of something like this playing out, right? So one of the things that happened in Portland is that, if we notice, Trump deployed elements of the Department of Homeland Security, which were specifically run by sympathizers of his. So not every Trump appointee is as enthusiastic about Trumpism. But what he did was he found, you know, Federal Protective Service, Customs and Border Protection, U.S. Marshals, ATF. These are agencies within the Department of Homeland Security that they specifically appointed Trump sympathizers to run. People that are ideologically on their side. And then Chad Wolf, who is the acting head of the Department of Homeland Security, obviously is a super hardcore Trump supporter. And what this was, in part, was Trump was identifying elements of the Department of Homeland Security that are loyal and was in some ways testing that loyalty. He was sending them into a dangerous situation, seeing how they would behave. There have been many articles written about how what was going on in Portland is likely a test drive for what we're going to see in November, December, January. And I think that analysis is at least in part right on. What Trump knows right now is that he can count on at least four or five agencies within the Department of Homeland Security to do his bidding. Now, all of the personnel of those four or five agencies, though, are not enough to deal with a nationwide uprising over him refusing to leave office. And I think they're going to learn that lesson the hard way. Because what's going to end up happening here is, if that breaks out, we end up with one of two outcomes here. And the Washington Post op-ed section has already been talking about this, right? So, like, we are not – this is not an extreme position. This is not a conspiratorial position. What we're saying right now is literally directly in line with Washington Post op-ed section from the last three or four days. And one of the things that they've been saying is, look, we might end up in a situation where we have to overthrow this administration. They directly said that. And if we do that, one of two things is going to result. Either Joe Biden's going to come to office and try and make everything go back to normal. Or, and this is probably more likely, Biden's going to come into office and they're going to round up and arrest a significant number of former Trump administration officials on official corruption charges. And the reason is that they have to set an example for what happens when you abuse power and then have to leave office, right? Because no one got to set that example with Nixon. He got pardoned. And so the running theory is that if that is the result of this election and we have to go to DC and we have to face off with the state, after that happens, if Biden is able to take office, which, you know, as far as I'm concerned, would be not the best outcome, but if he's able to take office, then they're probably going to round some of these people up and charge them with abuse of power, which carries significant prison terms. And so people like Chad Wolf, he's not only – Chad Wolf right now is doubling down to try and save his career because he knows if he doesn't, he's going to be out of a job relatively quickly. But in that process of doubling down, he is putting himself in significant legal jeopardy. And that's a thing that it seems like none of these people have really calculated yet, is that if Trump loses and they're not able to hold the streets if he refuses to accept the election, they're all going to prison, all of them, every single one of them, very likely, unless as a result of that uprising, the entire state implodes and there's just no prisons left to send them to, right? But what we're walking into is a crisis of historic proportions. It's a crisis unlike anything we've seen in the United States since potentially the Civil War.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.